Well, thank you, Brian, for setting this up and for giving me the opportunity to introduce my friend and former colleague, Christian Adams. Christian is both an election law lawyer and a columnist for Pajamas Media. In his capacity as a columnist, he has written a best-selling book called Injustice, Exposing the Racial Agenda of the Obama Justice Department, copies of which are available to my right. In promoting this book, Christian has been on the Mark Levin Show, Laura Ingraham, featured in the Limbaugh Letter, you know, Fox News, innumerable times. And his book is a bestseller. Christian was telling me that for a while his book was atop the charts, tied with the Herman Cain book among conservative books in sales. But the problem was that Herman Cain was using campaign money in order to purchase copies of his books and give them out at campaign events. So to sort of even the balance, I offered to accuse Christian of sexually harassing me. Christian said he just wasn't that desperate, probably a wise man. In his role as an election law lawyer, Christian has had a truly remarkable career. He started in South Carolina, where he's from, where he was general counsel to the Secretary of State in South Carolina, before later moving on to the Justice Department's voting section, where he and I had the privilege of working together. Christian had a remarkable record of success in bringing traditional civil rights cases on behalf of African-American voters, as well as cases on behalf of military voters. Christian also did something that was unique in the history of the Civil Rights Division, which is to bring the first successful case on behalf of white voters in the division's history. Christian went to the heart of black, Democrat-controlled Mississippi and brought and won a case on behalf of white voters who were being discriminated against by the black Democratic machine there. And in so doing, took quite a few slings and arrows, both inside the Justice Department and outside. Finally, of course, Christian was the lead attorney on the Black Panthers matter in Philadelphia, which some of you are probably familiar with. And as a result of his work there and the Obama administration's response, ended up resigning his position with DOJ. As a final comment, I just want to say that the Justice Department, when I was there, was filled and still is filled with innumerable attorneys who are brilliant, dedicated public servants. Christian certainly checks both those boxes, but I have never in my time in public service or elsewhere met a more courageous attorney or somebody more devoted to principles of public service. And with that, Christian.
Thank you. Thank you, Ashish, for that extremely kind introduction. I cannot emphasize enough how lucky you all are to have Ashish in Indiana, how unlucky we are to not have him in Washington anymore. We worked on a lot of cases that made a big difference in voting, and I hope that Ashish sees fit someday to come back, and I would love for him to come back to the Civil Rights Division, but it's a place where you've heard slings and arrows are a regular occurrence. I have to tell you, this is my first time in Indianapolis. I'm a Steelers fan, and I sort of am ticking off the NFL cities I've been to. And there's only one more left after this, actually, and that's San Diego. I've never been to San Diego. I don't really count Green Bay because it's not really a city. I've never been to Green Bay, and I don't suspect I ever will. But I have to tell you, I'm somewhat envious. The Roethlisberger Manning thing, some years it ebbs and flows and who's better and who's not. And, there's always sort of been an AFC little thing going with them and Tom Brady. I think they're probably the best three quarterbacks in the AFC. And earlier this summer, I thought to myself, boy, would I love to be a Colts fan this upcoming season, because you may get to play the Super Bowl in your home stadium. And that's got to be a very powerful incentive to having a good year. And last night, after one of the most frightening flights I've ever had in my life, I was sufficiently razzled that I could not sleep. So I thought, I'm going to do a little research. And I went back and I looked at the records, the win-loss records, of the home team for the Super Bowl in the regular season. And I realized there's a curse. There's a curse. If you are slated at the Super Bowl, you are not going to be there. Okay? The overall record, going back to the merger, I didn't go before the merger, and I didn't count Stanford, okay, because that's not really a home stadium. That's the one Super Bowl I left out. The winning percentage, the winning record of the Super Bowl host is 285 wins to 368 losses with a winning percentage of 43%. So and listen, this includes Miami Dolphins. Don't forget, they were hosting all in the 70s. They were hosting Super Bowls. Not just the Saints, okay? It's not just the Saints or the Buccaneers. It's also the L.A. Raiders and the L.A. Rams. So there's something about hosting the Super Bowl. So you shouldn't feel so bad. As a matter of fact, there's something attractive about a complete train wreck. I mean, it's like, seriously, if you're a sports fan, there's something amazing to behold about an undefeated season. Like, how do they keep winning? If you're on the other side of the pendulum, it's also, how do they keep losing? I mean, it's truly an attractive thing to me. Okay. No, if that's true. 43% would be good. But no, I think the Steelers played the Colts earlier this year. So, okay. As Ashish mentioned, I was in the voting section for 5 years. In fact, I served alongside Ashish on a lot of issues. And I probably wouldn't be here today if it weren't for the support that he gave me. And I'm very appreciative. Even if I had not written the book Injustice, which of course I did, but I would still tell you that anyone who cares about clean elections, voter integrity, and the power of your federal government, that it's a must-read for people who believe in the rule of law. Because that's what it's about. It's about the rule of law and federal government power. And lawyers, it's really a book for lawyers. It's about how the law interacts with important things. And I want to hit on some of the important highlights of the book that relate directly to the elections next year. For too long, people have assumed that elections run smoothly, that there's all these laws in place that are designed to safeguard the integrity of our elections, and that they're enforced fairly, and that law enforcement officials responsible for doing so are unbiased and dedicated to equal enforcement. It might be uncomfortable to hear otherwise. It might sound somewhat far-fetched that our Justice Department is aiding and abetting, in many ways, lawlessness in American elections, but that is exactly what is happening today. Consider bias. When I worked at the voting section, and when Ashish was in charge of the voting section, the idea that attorneys there would display their political biases was completely absurd. Nobody discussed politics in the office. Nobody would display their political preferences. We were enforcing federal election law. You just don't do that. But after the inauguration in 2009, everything changed. Remember, this is the agency of government that's responsible for federal election law. In my book, I have a photograph, actually two photographs. It's kind of hard to see. But these were taken earlier this year. These two pictures on the right, and they're taken from the inside of the voting section at Justice, where I worked, where they're going to be enforcing federal election law. And you can see this year Obama campaign posters hanging on the walls of the attorneys inside the Justice Department voting section. Okay, I didn't take these pictures. I'd already left. Somebody else took them for me. But these photos were taken after a memorandum was circulated by Assistant Attorney General Lee Loftus that made it clear that it was illegal for these pictures to be hanging. Okay? Not only did the attorneys disregard this law, they did so brazenly. And these are the folks who are going to be enforcing federal election law next year. But the problem goes far beyond just a few Obama posters hanging on the wall. After the inauguration, the Obama Justice Department, and you might say, why are you talking about the Justice Department so much? The Justice Department is the most powerful federal agency. When you hear about health care, when you hear about election issues, when you hear about antitrust issues, when you hear about anything that the federal government does, it all funnels through the Justice Department one way or another. They are the law firm for the federal government. So they are the law firm that represents the agencies. If you have an agency engaged in essentially overreach, it's because the Justice Department has agreed that they should. So if there's any single part of the federal government that, that is the, sort of the essence of why the government is so powerful, good or bad, it's the Justice Department. And so that's why my book focuses on the Justice Department, and in particular the Civil Rights Division. Well, after the inauguration, the Justice Department embarked on a campaign to fill the civil service ranks with some of the most radical attorneys you could find anywhere in the nation. The voting section was no different. Now, when I say radical, notice I'm not saying Democrats. I'm not saying liberals. I'm saying radicals. And they're going to be enforcing federal election law next year and everything else that they do. Consider Anna Baldwin. Anna Baldwin was one of the new hires into the voting section, and I write about her in the book, as well as other people. When I say radicals, this is what I mean. I'm just going to read from one paragraph from the book. Perhaps the voting section's most radical new hire was Anna M. Baldwin, a Harvard Law alumni. She came to the DOJ from the law firm of Jenner Block, where she practiced with current Associate Attorney General Tom Perelli. Baldwin was a militant gay activist at Harvard, serving as the leader of the, quote, queer resistance front. In one incident, she led a mob, and I didn't use that word lightly, she led a mob that harassed Jewish and Republican students attending a, quote, conservative coming out dinner. As the Harvard Crimson reported, bullhorn in hand, Anna Baldwin led about 30 poster-toting protesters who shouted, shame, 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 as dinner guests arrived to the event. On another, so this is, I'll skip the last part of it, it's sort of R-rated. It gives you a sense of the militancy of these attorneys. Now, I would think that that's almost a disqualifying feature. You know, you do something like that, an uncivil act against people just because of their political philosophy, sort of hurts your employment prospects. But as I document over and over and over again, these are exactly the qualifications that are being sought after by the Holder Justice Department, is a demonstrated record of militancy. Not liberalism, not just Democrat bona fides. I'm talking about genuine militancy. How does it manifest in your life? How does this ever matter? Consider Georgia. In 2009, Georgia adopted a law to ensure that only citizens were registering to vote. Shocking, isn't it? Only citizens are registering to vote. But because Georgia is covered by Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, something Indiana is not, but Georgia is, they had to submit this change to Eric Holder for preclearance. Okay, you are thankfully immune from this in Indiana, but 16 states are not. And every election change, even if it's moving a polling place, has to be typed up and sent to the Justice Department for approval or rejection. Okay? It came out of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. It's still the law of the land. One of the things I document in my book, and I'll get to back to Georgia in a second, is the close working relationship of the civil rights industry. I use that term because they're not the civil rights movement anymore, but the civil rights industry, with the Eric Holder Justice Department. One such organization is MALDEF, the Mexican-American Defense, MALDEF, Defense and Education Foundation. Okay, back to Georgia. So Georgia enacted this law, and MALDEF went crazy. They said, you can't preclear this, Justice Department, and they were intimately engaged with the DOJ because this particular DOJ invites them in. They're brothers in arms. So Georgia decided, they submitted to justice for reasons I can't quite explain, but that's another story. They could have gone to federal court. You can always go to federal court on a voting change instead of justice. And wouldn't you know that the Justice Department objected to this? Eric Holder said you cannot check citizenship before you accept registration of voters. The Justice Department gave MALDEF exactly what they wanted. They blocked the law. Georgia, thankfully, said, forget it, Justice. We're going to federal court. And while we're at it, we're going to challenge Section 5 as unconstitutional, which they did. And the people that I used to work with quickly retreated. I compared it to the Continentals in New York City. Like, they ran as fast as they could away from the plaintiff. And Justice totally caved in. Now, the person who was leading the charge against the Georgia citizenship verification is a woman named Elise Shore. I write about her in the book. But Elise Shore worked at Maldef. She was the triumphant winner in the citizenship verification fight. She's the one who got the DOJ objection. She won. Guess where she works now? She works in the DOJ voting section. Okay? So these people who have these completely crackpot ideas about your elections are being brought into the section to implement them to spread this as national policy. And it's happening now. Let's take a look at another example, Section 7 and Section 8 of Motor Voter. Here's where the CLE part comes in if it gets approved. Okay. National Voter Registration Act, passed in 1993. I guarantee everyone in this room remembers the debates about motor voter. It was the top priority of the Clinton administration as soon as he came to office. The idea is simple. You go to get your driver's license, you can register to vote. Everybody's experienced this. It was meant to open up the voter rolls to people. But it's not just DMV offices. Section 7 of Motor Voter, the same part as DMV, also extends to welfare offices, drug treatment facilities, food stamp offices, and any sort of public assistance agency. So when you go in to get your check, you're also offered a opportunity to register to vote. It was written by Francis Fox Piven, who you may have heard of Cloward and Piven fame, and it was a means to get all of those people who have a cozy relationship with the government onto the voter rolls. It's not just DMV. It's public assistance also. But there was a great congressional compromise called Section 8. Section 8 of Motor Voter is a voter roll maintenance requirement. In other words, you have to maintain the voter rolls of only eligible voters. That was the trade-off. It would have never gotten through the Senate or the House if Section 8 was not added. And it is a private right of action, folks. I'm going to get to why that's important in a minute. If you see problems with voter rolls, you can go out there and sue, and there's an attorney fee provision. Okay? Well, this Justice Department is suing states like Rhode Island and Louisiana for Section 7 violations, the welfare agency part, that is refusing to enforce Section 8. And I don't use the word refusing lightly. I write about it in the book. Ashish's successor, a woman named Julie Fernandez, who's a Deputy Assistant Attorney General, had a meeting convened at the voting section where she announced the Obama administration would not be enforcing Section 8. She made it perfectly plain and simple. What's worse is the voting section chief, a man named Chris Coates, had already recommended 8 investigations into states with corrupted voter rolls. 8 different states had problems. And Fernandez killed those investigations off and said, we're not interested in enforcing Section 8 because it doesn't do anything to, quote, increase minority turnout. I said that that's what she said under oath, and I'll say it again. They haven't contested that she said that. Okay? So here we have this situation where the Obama administration is enforcing welfare agency registration aggressively to pump up the rolls, but not enforcing Section 8. In Indiana, you actually have 13 counties with more people registered to vote than humans alive. Okay? In other words, the voter rolls have greater numbers than you have 18-plus citizens, according to the U.S. Census. Here's some of the counties. The worst one, and these names mean nothing to me, okay? So there might be a pattern here, I just don't know what it is. The worst county in the state is a county called Scott. Spencer, and this is in general declining order of bad. Crawford, Warwick, Tipton, Franklin, Warren, Union, Orange, Hancock. There's a couple others, but I didn't include them because they were right at the edge of 100%. But if you have more people than you have, more people in the voter rolls than you have people alive, you have a Section 8 case possibly. And at least the Justice Department should be looking into it, but they're not doing that. So, anyhow, one of the favorite pastimes of the civil rights industry and the radicals inside the DOJ is to also deny that voter fraud occurs. There's been a lot of noise about this in the last couple weeks, and it's frustrating for me to hear because I've proved it in federal court. I've won voting fraud cases in federal court, and in the book, I document how the civil rights industry has sort of become an intellectual smokescreen for criminal wrongdoing in the elections. Whenever officials are accused of voter fraud, groups like the NAACP, often jump to the defense of all the accused. They obviously always go silent after there's guilty pleas, but in the meantime, they get a lot of attention. Right now, the NAACP is on a PR blitz in the last 2 weeks to have Eric Holder object to voter ID laws in South Carolina and Texas. You in Indiana are very familiar with the fight about voter ID. South Carolina and Texas are subject to Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. So those voter ID laws are currently before the Justice Department for approval or rejection. Now, I talk about the NAACP so much because, in a way, the organization is an American tragedy. It was once proud, noble, and important, but unfortunately, one of their chief pastimes now is to facilitate wrongdoing in our elections. Just this week, the NAACP actually asked the United Nations Human Rights Commission to investigate states like Indiana who have enacted voter ID laws. I'm not kidding. And guess which country sit on this United Nations Human Rights Commission? Just listen up. China. Cuba. Saudi Arabia, who just recently beheaded someone on suspicion of sorcery. Nigeria, Kyrgyzstan, and Djibouti, where Christians are routinely persecuted. As I said in a piece I wrote at Pajamas Media 2 days ago, the NAACP has clearly jumped the shark. Okay? Or consider the case of Lessa Dalla Sowers. That's her name, Lessa Dalla Sowers. She was recently convicted of 10 counts of voter fraud in Tunica County, Mississippi. She forged and cast absentee fraudulent ballots. One reason that the NAACP so vociferously defended Lessa Dalla Sowers is because she served on their NAACP executive committee in Tunica, Mississippi. In my book, I described instance after instance of organized systemic voter fraud in this nation that goes unpunished or even condoned by people still working in the United States Justice Department. They do this solely because of the race of the wrongdoers. Despite the denials by the Attorney General, I name names in the book Injustice who some of these DOJ officials are. The dismissal of the new Black Panther case in Philadelphia, which I brought, was just the tip of the iceberg. It was only one of other cases where the race of the wrongdoer caused Justice Department officials to decide to turn a blind eye to criminal wrongdoing. Consider Hale and Perry County, Alabama. Hale and Perry County are down in the western part of the state, and what I'm about to tell you has had a big impact in the last month. If anyone has seen Congressman Arturs Davis, who is an African-American congressman from Alabama, in the last month has come out in favor of voter ID. And he said, I saw the damage that the failure to have ID did in my counties. And he's talking about what I'm about to tell you. So consider Hale and Perry County, Alabama. There's a woman down there named Faye Cochran who runs something called the Democracy Defense League. It's a voter integrity organization. And she got a call one day from a colleague of mine in the voting section named Avner Shapiro. And Shapiro had gotten a tip from an active civil rights group that Cochran and her group, the Democracy Defense League, were too concerned about dead people on the voter rolls and what was happening at the polls. So Shapiro shows up at this lady's house, who I've talked to on the phone many times. She's a very typical, like, pleasant old lady, okay, from Alabama. And Shapiro sits down, and Cochran proceeds to tell Shapiro, the DOJ guy, about all this voter fraud going on there, this racially motivated election crimes. Although Shapiro was sworn to enforce the Voting Rights Act, he grew agitated while listening to these stories from Faye Cochran. I'm not here to help you, he dismissively told her during one interview. I'm here to help the minorities only. Stunned, Cochran interjected that whites constituted a 39% minority in these counties. But Shapiro was unmoved. Quote, I'm not interested in helping the minority here, he declared contemptuously to her, quote, I'm here to help the national racial minority only, blacks. Okay? This is just one of many instances, just like the Black Panther case. It's no accident that Shapiro's wife, Julie Fernandez, the woman who succeeded Ashish, are married to each other. Okay, but don't assume it's just this husband and wife couple who are the root of the problem. The racialist corruption that I've described, this biased rot, is terribly dangerous. It's not just a nuisance. It's not just a scandalous train wreck like the moral mayhem of people like almost President John Edwards. Instead, it's a twofer, if you will. It's both a rotted abandonment of one of the most sacred principles captured by one of the greatest Americans, that all men are created equal. The rule of law is what separates us from all the failed experiments of history and the political squalor of much of the globe. When DOJ officials fail to enforce the law because they have racial allegiance with the perpetrators, we have entered into dangerous territory. The second part of this twofer is that it also undermines the integrity of our elections. Make no mistake, the new Black Panther case and the events I've described in Hale and Perry are not the only instances of corrupt lawlessness affecting American elections. In Minnesota, there have been hundreds of voter fraud convictions of felons who were, in this convictions, of felons who were unable to vote or ineligible to vote in the 2008 presidential election. Ineligible felons voted in the hundreds because they were convicted in the last year because they voted for president in 2008. I don't need to remind you that Al Franken won that election by 312 votes. He later provided the filibuster-proof vote in the Senate to pass Obamacare. So this voter fraud has consequences. What are the solutions? When I do radio or TV interviews about my book, Injustice, I'm usually asked, what can be done about this? What are the things people in this room can do in response to this situation? What can people do to stop the overreach of the Eric Holder Justice Department while at the same time promoting integrity in next year's elections? The first thing I tell people, principal advice I give my clients even, is to leverage law enforcement. Leverage law enforcement. Now, what do I mean by that? Let me share a little secret. Ashish will particularly enjoy this, because I don't know if we've ever had a chance to talk about this. This is after he left, by the way. The Democrats in the civil rights industry, like Project Vote is another group, spend a ton of time on the phone to the Justice Department, writing letters, demanding investigations, leveraging law enforcement to their cause. Republicans do virtually nothing. Democrats are skilled at finding a statutory predicate to demand action from the DOJ. During the 2008 presidential election, Obama lawyer Robert Bauer was making weekly demands on the voting section about this investigation he wanted opened, this problem he encountered. He was calling Chris Coates' office every week, writing letters also. As such, it put pressure on the DOJ to adopt the Obama campaign's agenda, or at least make inquiries sparked by Bauer's request. The Bauer's request was converted into the use of government resources to run down rabbit holes, because the request could not be ignored entirely. Guess how many requests for investigations or inquiries from the McCain campaign came in? How were they handled? They weren't. You want to know why? Because the McCain campaign never made any. In fact, some at the McCain campaign were given an edict that they were to not contact the DOJ voting section because it might create the impression of impropriety. Someone find me all the newspaper articles, even in the conservative press, criticizing the Obama campaign for exercising their First Amendment right to petition their government. They don't exist. When the Obama campaign was fighting to leverage law enforcement to their side, the McCain camp unilaterally disarmed. While the Obama campaign was demanding investigations into places like Chesterfield County, Virginia, or Michigan, that the Republican Party there, the McCain campaign had no requests to do something about corrupted voter rolls in places like Michigan and Colorado, where they had more registered people on a statewide basis than people alive in Michigan. Every time something happens that may implicate election law, you must document it, write it up, and send a request to the applicable law enforcement official and oftentimes someone at the Justice Department to do something about it. A request never made is a request never granted. The second thing I'd suggest to people is to push back. You might not have clients in this situation, but you might. Let's assume you're on the receiving end of a call from the Justice Department about some issue, maybe an election issue, as Chesterfield County, Virginia was over long lines at the polls. If you've read the book, you know that many DOJ inquiries are totally meritless. In one I discuss in the book, Alabama Attorney General Bill Pryor, who was the Attorney General in the last decade. He got a call from Justice saying, you need to submit your prisoner DNA collection scheme to Justice for Section 5 election preclearance. Don't even get me started on this. The details are in the book. Well, that came from the DOJ voting section. And Pryor said, go pound sand. I'm not going to do this. And it turns out that DOJ backed down because they couldn't do it. And as a matter of fact, the political people didn't even know this was happening. I discuss all the details in the book. But what's fascinating about this particular story, I'll share an aside. You always wonder if your book makes any difference. I heard Luther Strange, a very strange name, Attorney General in Alabama, read my book. And he told somebody, he got to the section about what I just talked about, the DNA collection, and he couldn't believe it. He's like, I can't believe this is happening. He ran over to the copier machine, and he faxed a copy to Bill Pryor, who's now in the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. He said, look at what was going on inside the Justice Department with your DNA collection scheme. And by golly, Luther Strange is putting his foot down and fighting Eric Holder on the immigration law now. And so he's emboldened by what he read in the book, the pushback advice. Okay, number three, third piece of advice, understand the scope of the problem. I often say in my speeches that I wish Bill Clinton were president. Give him back, please, to us. Well, imperfect, he was a very different kind of Democrat. You cannot underestimate the radicalism of this administration. You cannot underestimate the corrosive effect they're having on the rule of law. Whether it relates to Chrysler-secured bondholders, which your own Governor Mitch Daniels sought to protect here, or the idea that battlefield captures in Afghanistan should enjoy Miranda rights, a radicalism and lawlessness is infesting this administration. This is not just your grandfather's Democrats. This is not the Clinton administration. There is something happening that is different from anything we've seen before on legal issues. They are adopting legal positions from the far fringes of academia and bringing it into justice as public policy. Okay, the one area that might not be entirely true is antitrust, where at least I don't follow it closely enough, but I've been told by sane antitrust professors that they haven't quite gone whole crazy on antitrust, but other than that, they've gone whole crazy. In closing, it may be a mighty task to fumigate the Justice Department, perhaps in 2013, but attorneys who love the rule of law will be needed to bring back a sense of balance, fairness, and legality. Attorneys who recognize the proper constitutional limits on power are sorely lacking inside this DOJ, and they will be needed when the administration changes. That's why I'm glad to be here today, so glad also to be among friends who revere and respect the rule of law, because without folks like you and organizations like the Federal Society in particular, these ideas and these people would go completely unchecked. And so thank you very much for having me. It's been a delightful trip. And as Ashish mentioned, I will have books I'm happy to sign, and I'm also open to questions. So thank you very much.